It's been a week of controversy and confrontation in Durban and continued bloodshed in the Middle East. Dan Shore is away on vacation, whereas he has had his 85th birthday this week. We've gotten a lot of congratulations here, and we send them out to him should he be listening this morning. We're glad to be joined by our friend John Heilemann of Wired Magazine out in San Francisco. John, thanks very much for being back with us.
I'm happy to be here, Scott, and happy birthday, Dan.
John, the Middle East situation just seems to go from worse to worse to worse, if I might put it that way. Israeli forces moved into a Palestinian-controlled town on the West Bank for a couple of days this week. There were also a couple of, I think I can characterize them fairly as sensational deaths. Israeli forces denied that they were involved in the death today of Colonel Taser Katab, an intelligence officer. They say it must have been an internecine rivalry between the PLO and Hamas, perhaps. Earlier this week, Abu Ali Mustafa, a PLO leader, was assassinated. Israel says he was planning to conduct, I guess, an assault on an Israeli school that was to have occurred tomorrow, Sunday. Does there just seem to be a widening sense of hopelessness, and it's beginning to spill over even into the conference in Durban, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly right, Scott. The sense of hopelessness has just been kind of progressive over the last 6 months, and certainly, particularly in the last month. I think the question that people are starting to ask, however, and it is sort of the big question given the cycle of violence there, is what is Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's end game? He is engaged in a very delicate political balancing act. On one side, he's got the Israeli hardliners and much of the Israeli public. You know, 70% of the public support him. His approval ratings are very high right now. On the other side, he's got the Israeli left, or at least what's left of the peacenik crowd in Israel, and much of the international community that's sort of urging a softer line. So far, he's not shown much of his hand, and by that, I mean he's not shown much of what he thinks a viable peace would look like. But he can't continue to hold his cards that close to his vest for much longer. If he does, the Palestinians will have little incentive to stop shooting, and even his allies may begin to lose patience. It was lost on no one that this week the Bush administration, which previously had not said much of anything about Sharon's policies or about the situation in the Middle East of late, openly criticized the assassination policy, the pinpoint killing of certain Palestinian leaders who Israel calls terrorists, and as well as the Israeli incursion into Beit Jala. So the question is, when is Sharon going to start to show his hand? And that will tell us a lot about how things will play out over the next few months.
Let me ask a question about the Bush administration this week, because the thinking had always been that if Israel knew the United States would support it, whatever happens, Israel would then be in a position to make overtures, which after all, it has to live with and live by. What do we make of the criticism this week, particularly at a time that the United States is certainly standing by Israel at the Conference on Racism?
Well, I mean, I think they're playing. The Bush administration is, of course, trying to have this position where they're trying to keep a kind of neutral hand, and so you see these two things are kind of balanced off each other. The timing is, I think, interesting. On one hand, that the first real criticism from the administration of Sharon comes this week at the same time when, in a very public way, by not sending Colin Powell to the racism conference, they are taking a very public, although I think not in terms of policy, a very important stand, but at least in terms of a very public. Very public and very politically incendiary situation. Not sending Powell was a very strong sign of support, both for Israel and a very strong sign that the United States would not allow itself to be drawn into the kind of Zionism is racism kind of conflagration that's been playing out in Durban.
What kind of opportunities might be missed at the conference in Durban, not just on behalf of the United States and Israel, but of all of the assembled there in the way the conference seems to have gotten, at least for the moment, sidetracked into this conversation, or perhaps not sidetracked, obviously.
Well, it is. I mean, I think it is sort of a sidetrack in a way, Scott. I think that's right. I mean, I think the counter argument, I mean, the Bush administration, I think, is sort of right in some sense not to send Powell. On the other hand, the counter argument would have been that Powell, because of his race and because of his sort of stature, is in some ways, you know, certainly in the United States, the most powerful African-American public figure, that he could have made the U.S. arguments on this issue incredibly powerfully in Durban. But I think more. So that kind of is a missed opportunity on this specific issue. And then I think more broadly, this conference was supposed to have a very broad agenda, not just certainly not just Israel or Palestine, but not even just racism, but ethnic hatred and xenophobia, intolerance of all kinds, everything from, you know, discrimination against women in Afghanistan to slavery in the Sudan. But instead, you've ended up really with this one issue overshadowing everything. And I think that really is a pity. Jesse Jackson made a comment, which I thought was really one of the few real on-the-money statements to come out of the conference, which is that, you know, the issue of racism is too big to reduce to the controversy about the Middle East. And that if one gets into labeling, I think was his quote, there are a lot of labels to go around.
Let me ask you about the charges against Slobodan Milosevic. UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague this week expanded the charges to include Bosnia, Kosovo, and Croatia. And the prosecutor there says that she believes all of that can be bundled into one trial. Does this sound to you overly ambitious?
Well, I think that for a long time, people have been assuming, as this tribunal has started to kind of come together, that this case was going to be an open and shut sort of slam dunk case. And I think even on the more narrow charges, that was probably not true. Mm-hmm. I think that the notion that Slobodan Milosevic is in some sense responsible for a vast array of atrocities and war crimes is beyond doubt. But this proceeding is a legal proceeding and an incredibly important one for the future of international law. And its objective is to determine Milosevic's guilt in the strict legal sense. Milosevic is quite unlikely to have actually killed anyone himself. He may not even technically have ordered any killings. And establishing a chain of command from him personally or his offices to the sites of any specific atrocities won't be easy. I think that by broadening and expanding these charges against mm-hmm. him to include genocide in Bosnia now and war crimes in Croatia, the prosecutors may have given their case greater moral force, in a sense, but made their legal challenge even more formidable.
Mm. Let me ask you about something out in the Bay Area. Jim Clark, the founder of Netscape, is withholding $60 million from Stanford University because he does not agree with the Bush administration's limits on stem cell research, whatever the permission they granted might be. What sort of impact do you think he is hoping to have with this decision?
Well, I think in this debate, we've sort of heard from two sides. We've heard from the scientists and we've heard from the anti-abortion activists, basically very loud partisans in this debate. I think what Clark has done is he's spoken up in a way for, certainly for Silicon Valley, but more broadly for the high-tech entrepreneur and for the high-tech philanthropist. I mean, and these are kind of two kind of bound up subgroups. Clark's objection is not just to the stem cell issue, but also to the question of Congress banning therapeutic cloning. Mm-hmm. I think that in Silicon Valley, that is a consensus. The opposition to those positions is pretty widespread. A lot of people think here that biotech and genetic engineering are not only going to be the source of incredible advances in science and medicine, but also as potentially vast new important industries. And I think that they worry that without this federal support on both these issues of it, and with these new restrictions, that you're likely to not see the U.S. Not only will the U.S. not be leading on the scientific front, but it also won't be on the leading edge of collecting the economic spoils that go along with scientific advances of that kind.
John, let me ask you this finally. You were once a big, strapping Little League ball player. What do you make of Danny Almonte, the 12-year-old who is now revealed as a 14-year-old?
Well, you know, we don't have very long, but I will say this. You know, this story, the story of what's happened here is an old story. It's happened since Little League was invented. And the primary culprits in this case, I think, are the same as they always are, not the league officials, not the coaches, certainly not the kids, but those individuals who are the source of all that's corrupt, petty, vain, megalomaniacal, and just plain wrong in the realm of peewee sports, and that's the parents.
Where can we reach you by email so we can just send it on?
I am anonymous at anonymous.com.
All right. Thanks, John. John Heilman of Wired Magazine in San Francisco.